Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be always acceptable in my sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Please be seated. Today is April Fool's, and there are hoaxes and there is foolishness around the world. That's true of the other 364 days on this planet as well. But April Fool's is the day we claim to know that we're joking. I was very surprised to find my sermon here when I arrived. 500 years before Christ, on Sizdar Bedar, in the beginning of April, Persians played tricks on one another. In ancient Rome, they tried out old pranks at the festival of Hilaria. In medieval Spain, at a festival of fools, they sent innocentes on a fool's errand. In France, to this day, someone may sneak up and pin a paper fish on your back and shout, Poisson d'avril, April fish. In some countries, many of them British Commonwealth, April Fool's jokes are supposed to stop at noon. This is a problem for revelers who like to sleep late. But in other countries, the clowning goes on until late in the night. Sometimes the jokes are elaborate. In 2008, the BBC reported on a newly discovered colony of flying penguins. In an elaborate newscast, Terry Jones of Monty Python met with these penguins in Antarctica and followed their remarkable flight to the Amazon rainforest. My mother, a fourth grade teacher, who celebrated every holiday, holy day, of every possible religion, practiced simple, old standard pranks on her children, shorted our sheets, put toothpaste in the fillings of Oreo cookies, softened the sugar. If the sugar had lost its savor, it was April Fool's, a comedy. The unexpected happened. In April, the cruelest month, the expected unexpected shows us on every petal, every leaf, the word reborn. Behold, all things are become new. Paradise is promised. Paradise is given. Grace, like mercy, comes to us, a gift not strained, not constrained, falls on us like April rain, if we will just stand still and let it. Good news. Today on April Fool's, Palm Sunday, we hear the comedy of Christ, the Passion. Passion, though, is from pati, to suffer, to endure. And yet, by the 13th century, the word also meant strong desire. By the 16th, sexual desire. By the 20th, a passion pit was a phrase for teenagers in love at a drive-in movie. And now in the 21st, Passion Pit is, I understand, an electro-pop band from right here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Passions ran strong, as we just heard. Our parts acted out for us in this play, the Gospel of Mark's Passion. Simon, are you asleep? The one I shall kiss is the man. Crucify him. truly this was the Son of God. We are the actors in this story, for it is our story. Your past minister here at Memorial, Peter Gumbs, preached of this passion. This is the story that the faithful told to one another. This is the story that is at the heart of the gospel. And if you cannot take this story, there is no good news for you. You cannot choose. It is the story, and everything else comes from it. So what is the story we just heard today? What kind of story? It's a fast-moving plot filled with high drama, a parade, acts of kindness, acts of cruelty, interrogation and torture, lashes and twisted thorns, alabaster vase of ointment poured on his head. Peter, the denying friend, Judas, the betrayer with his kiss, Simon, who carried the cross, Mary's weeping, public execution, darkness at noon, three crosses under the balcony of heaven, the curtain of the temple torn in two, the longest running play on the stage of our faith. Always a mystery play, always a miracle play. Quem quaeritas? Whom do you seek? Non est hic. He is not here. He is risen just as he foretold. Go into the world and proclaim the good news to the whole creation. Good news? Passion? Suffering? Undeserved? Unjust? Miss Prism, the governor, the governess, you may remember from Oscar Wilde's Importance of Being Earnest, the woman who accidentally exchanged the manuscript of her 3-volume novel for a baby, tells us that fiction means the good end happily and the bad unhappily. We conclude from her remark that Miss Prism wrote very bad fiction, no more than an imitation of life. As a novelist myself, I have always resisted the cataloging of fiction into genres. There are good novels and less good novels. It's probable that bad novels rely on stock plots and generic characters. But to make hierarchies of genres beforehand, for example, this is a mystery novel, we'll shut our ears and close our eyes. Crime and Punishment, Intruder in the Dust, To Kill a Mockingbird, they're all mystery novels. Should they be shelved separately from literature? And in the same limiting way, critical tradition has seen comedy as somehow lesser, holding a secondary position to tragedy. You hear of great comic novels, but did you ever hear anyone speak of a great tragic novel? I suspect not. No more than you ever heard anyone described as a wonderful male novelist, or a fantastic white actor. And yet the yes that ends the best comedy is fully as hard to come by as the tragic never of a Lear. Comedy is not only incongruity and surprise, the moment when a pompous rich man has his top hat knocked off and then he slips on a banana peel. There's a different unexpectedness at play in the great comedies. The moment comes to me as Charlie Chaplin's film Modern Times, when Chaplin, the little tramp, the white night watchman in a department store in his black baggy clothes, skates blindfolded, extravagantly, recklessly, perfectly graced, half his body leaning out over the unprotected ledge of a high balcony above what would be, if he fell, a fatal fall. He skates with blind faith. It is his gift to the girl who is with him. We remember that Wile E. Coyote falls into the canyon, plummets into the abyss, only when he runs out halfway over it and then looks down and loses faith. In comedy, blocking fathers may not want their daughters to marry the young man who can't give her anything but love, but yes is stronger than no. And in the end, Squire Western will rescue Tom Jones from the hangman's noose. Life force will win out over old stuffed shirts and Pharisees. Huck Finn won't be civilized, but light out for the territory. Gene Kelly will keep singing in the rain. Chekhov, the Russian playwright, always insisted the cherry orchard was a comedy. He would run down the aisle of the theater and yell at Stanislavski, "It's not tragic. Just because all the characters have lost everything they owned and they're grieving and sobbing doesn't mean their fate is tragic." Listen to the titles of tragedy: Oedipus, Hamlet, Othello, Death of a Salesman, Solitary, Heroically Alone. Listen to the titles of comedy: As You Like It, All in the Family, The Bridesmaids. It's a crowded throng. You cannot be in a comedy by yourself. A comic world takes more than one. When the last shall be first, you end up in a circle. You hold out your hands and wind your way together in a dance as Fra Angelico's blessed souls wind their way up the hill to paradise. Comedy invites us to join the wedding feast, the funeral wake, the dance. You can't stop the beat, sings Hairspray. And everybody can dance. You don't have to dance well. There are no exclusions. Female, male, white, black, old, young. We are cordially, from the heart, cordially invited to a party. Christ said yes to the parade, waving palms, shouting Hosanna, riding in lowly pomp to those huddled, faithful, sorrowful at the cross. Another Russian artist, Dostoevsky, not somebody we generally think of as a laugh riot, said, "You can know a man from his laugh. And if you like a man's laugh, before you know anything else about him, you may confidently say he is a good man." We know how often Jesus groaned within. Jesus wept. But Jesus laughed. When I titled this sermon, "The Comedy of Christ," I wasn't thinking of the Messiah as a stand-up comedian like Woody Allen or Ellen DeGeneres or Chris Rock, though the Gospels are rich in his humor and ironic wit. "You hypocrite, take the log out of your own eye And then maybe you'll be better able to see the speck in your brother's eye. That's funny. Jesus wept outside the tomb of Lazarus, wept with the family, just as family and friends were later to weep outside his tomb. But what happens next? Weeping is not where the story of Lazarus ends. He cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth!" And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus saith unto them, "Loose him and let him go." What a party there must have been. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, "Look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, always going to parties, having a glorious time. Sometimes eating with the poor, sometimes going to the tax collector or a Pharisee's. He was the life of the party. What a guest to have if your wedding planner seriously miscalculated the alcohol. Here's someone who could turn water into hundreds of gallons of wine. What a speaker to have at your large outdoor picnic if you overbooked. Someone who could stretch a few loaves and fishes to serve 5,000. Feasts, festivals, eating, drinking, with women, with Gentiles, no exclusions. Maybe even met that lowest crew of all actors. There was a theater only an hour from Galilee. In a recent poll by a leading UK daily, readers were asked to name their, quote, ideal dream dinner party guest. Guess who won? Jesus. He was the first choice by 74%. The second choice was Leonardo da Vinci. Maybe it was Leonardo DiCaprio. Sure. Asked what question they'd put to Jesus at this dinner party, a third of the responders said they would ask him if he really were the Son of God. That's the sort of question that made Christ groan within. There's a novel of mine, Handling Sin, which is the name of the medieval poem that serves as its beginning. It's the only novel of mine that was ever shelved in nonfiction. I found that out. Someone wrote me that they'd seen it in a bookstore placed among the self-help books. I always loved that the bookstore owner actually thought someone would come in and say, "I'm having trouble handling sin. Where can I get some help?" Right, over here. This is a novel of a comic quest on which one Raleigh Hayes, a serious, responsible, obsessively righteous son, an insurance salesman who believes you can insure life against the risks of loss and love, has been sent by his eccentric and irresponsible and irrepressible father, Early, a defrocked Episcopal minister, who wants Raleigh to learn that only by handling sin with others can we join ourselves to life. Now, Raleigh has always found Christ absolutely infuriating. Zapping all those demons out of the possessed, putting them into 1,000 pigs who jump off a cliff. What about the poor farmer who owned those pigs? What about that son who wasn't a prodigal wastrel? Raleigh wants to be a tragic hero, but he finds himself in a comedy. And after a long, infuriating trip to save his inheritance, on April Fool's, Maundy Thursday, he tracks down his father, who's dying from a heart attack, in a small, dingy nightclub in the French Quarter of New Orleans, playing the trumpet with a motley crew of jazz musicians, people that Raleigh has accidentally gathered on his pilgrimage and come to love, though he doesn't know it yet. And Early asks Raleigh, "Help me out. Want me to get a doctor?" Raleigh says. Early says, "No, I want you to do me a favor." "What is it?" "We were going to play one of my favorites in the end. It appears I haven't the heart for it." "Daddy, don't joke. Some stand in for me, son." "Sure you can. Just play I Can't Give You Anything But Love. Just the melody line. There's nothing to worry about." "Quit saying no, Raleigh. Remember the last time you played it?" Raleigh didn't think he did. Then he saw himself standing in a makeshift circus ring with his father, trumpets side by side. The old man patted his son's knee. "I swear it's the last crazy thing I'll ever ask you to do. Honestly, Daddy, it's not that I want, I can't. I can't play by ear. I have to have things written down." "Have you got a piece of paper?" "Oh, Daddy." Raleigh felt into his jacket and found his small accountant's book. And Early wrote on the book and reached his hand up and put it in Raleigh's. "Play me on out, son." "Don't say that. You aren't going anywhere, Daddy." A blue eye winked open. "Oh, I sure hope I am." And Raleigh swallowed a taste like vinegar and said something he never would have expected to say. "Let me know. I'll be listening." Raleigh Whittier Hayes, his tie precisely knotted, pushed on his glasses and checked against the piece of paper. He watched the saxophonist's shoe, and then his own foot began to move, and one and two, and "I Can't Give You Anything But Love." Staring hard at the shaky block printed letters, G, F sharp, E, G, he could still see in the corner of his eye the shoulder of his father's bare, thin, white arm. Above the music, he heard the sharp sound as the trumpet fell over. He turned and saw the gold fluted bell rock once back and forth on the floor, then the gold blurred, and Raleigh couldn't blink his eyes clear enough to read the paper. And it was strange to him, a man who had rested all his life on his reason, that while he could not see the notes, he nevertheless kept on playing because he could hear them. At the beginning of this trip, Raleigh thinks his neighbors are fools and he himself is wise. Now he knows better. The wise man knows himself to be a fool for Christ, a fool for love. If you love your neighbor as yourself, you are not far from the kingdom of heaven. Mercy and compassion are not easy for us. Not to start, because it cannot be earned. We want those pigs to be paid for. But once we do start to feel merciful, it is so easy. It washes through us like rain falling into a sea of compassion. It's even harder for us to receive mercy because we know it is not earned. But once we tilt up our heads and smile into the rain, what a glorious feeling. We're happy again. We're in a comedy together in which only the brief roles that we separately play come to an end. And even then, the dead only die if we do not keep loving them. When I was younger, I could remember anything, whether it had happened or not. Now I just tell the truth. The truth of this good news is stranger than fiction. It is a tragedy turned into comedy, and that is a mystery. But all our stories are mysteries. The Passion of Christ is a mystery story in which the death of the hero, accepted, willed, human, is no death at all. Death has no dominion where it once reigned supreme, because that partygoer, Christ, invited us to his feast. Fed, healed, heard, saw, forgave, died for the multitude of us, for the common crowd, the whole troop of players, one by one by one. Thank God, down in the pit of our individual passions and sorrows and the horrors we inflict and those we suffer, thank God they are all turned by the astonishing gift of love into a new creation, a comedy of shared humanness. Here are the lessons of comedy, that we are like one another, that our laughter is a prayer, that forgiveness is a gift to the giver, that grace in this life is possible, but it takes courage, and that the waste of love is the worst of sins. Stories can teach us these lessons, like the parables, because people feel safe in fiction, and when they are not afraid, they will risk tolerance, acceptance, kindness. They will step around their private limits into communion. When you write a comedy, you ask readers to say yes, to join the dance, to play in the band. Comedy reminds us that life goes on in its wonderful, horrible clutter. We might as well stop saying no and go with it. When we do, we cannot be afraid. And as we are daily reminded, nothing is more dangerous than fear. When you are laughing in the fullness of your heart, you cannot be afraid, nor can you hate. You can cry. You can laugh till you cry. But you cannot hate. It's because we love our family so much that we can't stand to be around them. If we didn't love them, we wouldn't care whether we were around them or not. Everything would be comfortable and easy and civilized. You have to love people for them to make you weep and groan within and laugh. In the divine comedy, the commedia, the last act is paradise. For that first fall, that initial slip on the banana peel was, from the beginning, April Fool's, a happy fall, a felix culpa. For when the women arrived at the tomb, they found the stone rolled away. Now, winding our way together, not with solitary steps, but hand in hand, as best we can, we join the crowded, noisy, dusty pilgrimage of family, neighbors, strangers who share our road, sometimes with palms, sometimes following a cross. We ride on through our little lives on this fragile earth. Amen.